Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And don't forget, designers, graphic artists, anyone with a visual knack, the deadline is this weekend to take part in our Map Your Moves Data Visualization Challenge. We asked our listeners to fill out a form listing everywhere they've lived over the last decade and why they moved. Almost 2,000 people responded, and now it's up to you graphic designers and other artists to make that information beautiful. We're making all the data available to download. We want you to present the data as a map, image, movie, or anything visual. It's up to you if you want to participate. All of your submissions will be displayed on our website. Download the data set and find all the information you need at our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we've already posted a few of the submissions that we've received. Folks can find a link and check it out right now. There's one from Alexandra that tries to capture the scope of the entire data set, and two from Michael that hone in on where people move to when they leave Manhattan but stay in the city, and where people who move to his Park Slope neighborhood have come from. They're really cool. So check them out at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and then the scrapbook. And for all you graphic designers and other artists, if you want to participate in this, you have until this weekend to do it. You can download the data set for free at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, think of it as open source visualization, if you like. And speaking of open source, millions of students are getting ready to descend onto college campuses, and they're about to drop a lot of money on books. Some are already there and doing it because of the start of the school year coming early. It's a huge market, and it's changing. Ever heard of open source textbooks, electronic rental textbooks? Well, Michael Cater is back for the third installment of our August weekly series on books and the future of the publishing industry. He's the founder of Publishers Marketplace and the widely read daily newsletter for the publishing industry, Publishers Lunch. So far in the series, we've talked about the future of the brick and mortar bookstore, the rise of ebooks, and today, the college market. Michael Cater, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Glad to be back with you.
So what exactly are open source textbooks?
Open source textbooks are this idea. It's a dual idea. First, it's the idea that sort of like Wikipedia, people can build a text and make it live and grow. But it's also the idea that professors and students want to take a textbook and not have it be a fixed thing. They want to play with it themselves just for their class. They want to add annotations. They want to extract just particular chapters and customize it to their course.
Explain how textbooks are traditionally produced and sold. It's a unique business in that state and public authorities have a lot of power in the market. It's big business for publishers and for authors. And, of course, with the size of state universities around the country, government actually has a lot of say. So how does this actually work?
Well, it's a big business. Textbooks are different on the college level than they are on the K through 12 level. So it's on the K through 12 level right now that the states exercise the most power, and it's the biggest states, Texas and California in particular, that, mm-hmm. that have the greatest power over what people buy. On that side, California has had an initiative to build open source textbooks to draw on the resources of their own faculty and to slowly replace commercial textbooks with ones that have been more or less built Wikipedia style. But in California, that's focused on high school for now. We can expect that that's going to transfer over to college at some point. In the college market, you have basically five extremely large companies that pretty much dominate the market. And historically, unlike the consumer book market, where we get to choose what we want to buy, and that drives choice and price and retail success, a lot of college books are about the assignments, which books the professors choose, which books they're telling their students we're going to use this year. So you have different economic forces at work, right? So the professors have had less incentive historically to choose books that have price points or other characteristics that the people buying them, the students, might like.
Right.
So that's why you've gotten this wacky market where the list price of the brand new textbooks appear to go higher and higher. So first we have this used book market where students figured out how they could sort of combat the economics of the high list prices. And now the big thing this year is these rental textbooks. So whether online or in physical stores, students now have the opportunity to rent textbooks for specified periods of time for different price points. They can extend those rentals. They can buy the book after the rental's over. They can do it online through a company called Chegg.com and never even have to walk into a college bookstore. They can now do it through BarnesandNoble.com and Follett, which sort of control the college bookstore operation market. They can even rent electronic texts, which haven't had a lot of momentum yet, but you can see how that's something that might gain momentum more. It sort of means the list prices don't have to come down because now they're just charging you for a period of time of access to the material instead of outright ownership of the wrapper that the material is in.
So, listeners, any questions or comments about open source textbooks? Anybody involved in open source textbook writing or anything else about the textbook market? For Michael Cater from Publishers Lunch, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Give us a call or post your thought or your question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You know, when you talk about open source, when you talk about wiki-style textbooks, people think of Wikipedia, which raises the question, what about quality control for open source textbooks? We know that Wikipedia is a wonderful resource, but that things are going to be wrong on Wikipedia more than they're going to be on, in traditional encyclopedias. So you can't have textbooks, which are supposed to be the academic gold standard of rock-solid information, having those kinds of hit-or-miss facts.
Right. Well, and to be clear, so far on open-source textbooks, what it really means is commissioned textbooks to begin with that are then made open within the classroom environment. You actually have a company up in Irvington, New York called Flat World Knowledge that's making open source textbooks available. And there they're commissioning regular textbooks, but then the professors can alter those textbooks or even the students to suit their particular environment, or students can add and share notes within a class. You also have some university systems, Rice University and down at the University of Georgia, where it's not completely open, right? But they have all these people who are on staff who are supposed to know their subject area. And instead of letting faculty write for other textbook companies, they're trying to organize the knowledge and skill sets within their own faculty to produce the text materials that their students are going to use.
Do you think this is improving the quality of material that students get to study in addition to affecting the market forces?
I think it's certainly bringing more voices to bear, and theoretically the folks doing the teaching are the ones who ought to know their material. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing social networking wrapped around books so that students and teachers and teaching assistants can sort of be discussing the text online and sharing notes and helping each other learn the material, which is another way that this half-open process is coming to bear.
I'm curious, too, before we take some phone calls, whether you think these new forms of delivering books to students change academia in a more fundamental way. There's a publishing requirement, as we all know, publish or perish, for professors to get tenure. But if publishing completely changes, does academic writing and research change?
It's entirely possible. I think there's a difference between the textbook writing, which has been limited to a fairly small circle of professors, and the academic papers and journals, which have been the requirement of a professor's resume, which are generally not intended for a very wide audience, but are designed to move forward scholarship rather than moving forward teaching. And I think there's a clear line of distinction between those two. I think clearly we're moving towards a more collaborative world in everything we do, where we're used to hearing from a lot of voices and putting a lot of voices together to come up with something better. I think textbooks have been relatively fixed, even as knowledge and what we do with that knowledge changes. So I think in some ways the environment's responding to cultural forces.
As we talk about the new trend toward open source textbooks on WNYC with publishing expert Michael Cater, here's a college professor, Emily in Montclair. Hi, Emily, you're on WNYC.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I have a question about the fact that textbooks in subject areas that don't really go out of date that quickly. Like if you do a literature textbook with a collection of you know, literature, then what happens often is professors do the book, it's out there, it's doing nicely, and then used books become available, and so the publisher pressures, insists that the professor make a new edition of the book, revising it, putting in new readings, and there's no really good academic reason for it. It's just simply we have to have a new book out to get, you know, for students to buy this new book. And I wonder if there's any way to address that. And the second is, well, one thought I have about that, and I teach in the social sciences, is that couldn't there be small paperback updates that would supplement the book? Because in our field, it does go out of date fairly quickly in psychology. So if we had updates, paperback updates, that then after a few years, a new full book would come out. Is anyone thinking about those possibilities? And I don't know how to solve a literature one.
Michael, you think?
Well, as we were saying before, I think part of the problem is there are many ideas for a more economically efficient textbook environment for the user and perhaps the professor. But since the students aren't the ones who get to choose, the economics come out in a wackier way. So that's why you wind up with rentals and these other programs to try to save kids money, even if it's a new edition, quote unquote.
I teach at a public university where we do know our students have, you know, limited means, and I think most of us do try to sign less expensive books where we can, and we don't like to sign new books if we don't have to.
Well, and I think that's why some university systems are trying to take hold of the textbook process themselves. Now, of course, the textbook companies will tell you that they make huge investments in the creation and marketing of these materials, and that everybody focuses very much on what the textbooks cost and aren't focusing as closely on what the tuition costs, where also the consumers really don't have a lot of say, right? The prices keep going up, and the choices attend or not attend, or look for a university that might have a somewhat lower price but is still very expensive. So it's an entire world that's somewhat removed from traditional economic forces. The textbooks, I think, become the hot button because it's something you have to keep buying again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And it's like buying bottled water out of your food budget, right? When you're looking for something to cut, you look for the small things that come out of your pocket all the time rather than the big things that you feel like you may or may not have some influence over.
Emily, thank you. By the way, some people think the iPad is really aimed at the education book market more than the trade book market, and you can certainly see it from a weight in your backpack point of view. But will e-readers and digital books actually save students money?
Again, it will probably be more efficient. The leader so far in e-textbooks has actually been a site called CourseSmart.com, which is a joint venture of all the major textbook companies, some of whom also sell their e-textbooks directly. So whether it saves students a lot of money or simply makes the process more efficient for them or, again, lets them rent or buy just the piece of text they
want.
Right,
because Apple and Amazon do not allow users to share digital files, right? So the used book market, in effect, would be much harder to purvey under that kind of system, right?
Exactly. You can't sell an used e-book. There are digital rights management technologies that make it pretty easy, in fact, for the vendors to control whether you're buying / renting your e-textbook for a day, a week, a year. There are a lot of interesting technologies to make electronic texts work better. And one of the things textbooks companies did recently was to supplement the print books with all these electronic materials, once again to try to remind professors and students that there's a lot of extra value here. So some of those extra features are going to get wrapped into the e-book version of the textbook. So the books may get better, or they may get richer, not necessarily cheaper. Although, again, if we get these rental options and other ways where students can buy just the access they want, then at least you don't have that problem where you say to yourself, I'm paying $120 for a 1,200-page text, and we only use 3 chapters. Mm.
Tony in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. Very interesting topic, gentlemen. The reason why I'm calling is with respect to what you were just talking about, digital rights. When these professors or these teachers or whomever are taking these digital books, when does the copyright law apply? Because you were saying, and I may be misspeaking, that we would parse the book and take different sections out. but which is all well and good, but if they're grouping it with other chapters of other authors who the particular author doesn't particularly care for, or if they're changing text, or even just removing a photo, copyright law applies to all of that and how they can get around it.
Copyright law certainly does apply. The publishers have, in fact, been very aggressive for years about making sure that not only professors but also the local college copy shop is aware of these rules. You know, for years, before we had the ability to splice and dice electronically, we had what were called course packs, where the local copy shop would be manufacturing copies of different articles and things that the professor had assembled. We've come a pretty long way between both education and lawsuits in people understanding that those pieces of material are all protected. It is an obstacle if you want to pick and choose electronically from all kinds of sources to make sure that there's an easy system to clear those rights and to make compensation to the rights holders. I think that's part of what, once again, is driving this open source movement, where some of the rights issues can get simplified if the process works out over time.
And Google Editions is launching sometime this year, and it's like a cloud bookstore in the digital cloud. Google says nearly all U.S. publishers are on board and that they'll have some 4 million books available. So would that have copyright implications? And explain how that would work.
Well, on the Google Edition side is all governed by contracts that Google's entered into with individual publishers to participate in that system. Slightly more complicated is these older, no longer commercially available books that Google also scanned, where we've been waiting eagerly for a decision from the court about a settlement that would once again put in place an apparatus that would allow for compensation of the rights holders for those works. So certainly on the edition side, Google is being very careful and is directly under contract with publishers. And the interesting thing there is, again, from the data, we know a lot of college students will, in fact, resist buying the text until the last possible minute. And it may be that once Google Editions launches, that students like it for that last minute looking up an article or looking up source material to try to get up to speed when they didn't buy the required materials for the class.
Yeah, and we just have a minute, but Google Editions would also make their ebook collection available for independent booksellers, I understand, essentially being a wholesaler for smaller retail outlets, which so far have been shut out of that market. Could university systems somehow get in on that?
It's entirely possible. Google's intention, in fact, is to be a wholesaler for a whole variety of retailers. They've gotten a lot of attention for their agreement with independent booksellers because it's been very hard for independent booksellers up until now to participate meaningfully in the ebook market. But Google also has arrangements with other online retailers, and it's certainly their ambition to provide that service to any online retailer that wants to work with them.
Michael Cater with the third installment of our series on books and the future of the publishing industry. He's the founder of Publishers Marketplace and the widely read daily newsletter for the publishing industry called Publishers Lunch. Thank you so much. This was a great one, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All right. Thanks a lot. See you then.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.